Feeds for the Afterbeat podcast are at feedburner.com. Got a feed? Burn it at feedburner.com. www.feedburner.com. You can always find the Afterbeat for free on the iTunes store on our page there, and also at the website AfterbeatPod, www.afterbeatpod.com. You'll find show notes, pictures, except for this episode, because I forgot to take Bob's picture. But in general, pictures from the session and sort of updated info on what's going on here at the Afterbeat and with our people that we interview. So that's www.afterbeatpod.com. I should mention Afterbeat Pod is a Squarespace site, Squarespace for exceptional websites, www.squarespace.com. Today's episode features saxophonist, bandleader, composer Bob Shepard, somebody I've known for quite a while, but haven't seen in a while. As Bob said says in the intro, last time we were hanging out together, he had hair, so it's been some time. Anyway, he had a lot to say about himself, a lot to say about education and practicing and what it takes to get where he is, and it was a good talk. I really enjoyed it. It's good to see Shepard again. So there it is, today's Afterbeat podcast with Bob Shepard. Here we go. Comfortable. Yeah, don't be that comfortable.
I'll be all right.
All right. As long as you're all right. Bob Shepard is here and he's all right, according to him, anyway. Have we started? Yes, we started.
Now I'm getting nervous.
Yeah. So, sax player, composer, band leader, veteran of Steely Dan and much more. And somebody I haven't seen in a while, but it's been a while.
It's been
quite a while.
Maybe when I had hair last time.
I wasn't going to bring that up.
Very possible.
You did, in fact, have hair. You have some hair. I can see in the backlighting, you have some hair, but perhaps less.
It's been quite a few years.
It's been a while, yeah. And you're good? Everything's good?
You're great. Busy? Everything's great, actually, yeah.
You're a busy guy.
Well, just, you know, I'm still alive, where a lot of my friends are not around anymore.
Yeah,
and that's true. From a bigger perspective. You know, I have a nice life, and I still play the horn, and I have great friends, and still trying to learn how to play the right notes in the right place.
Yeah.
And so that's good. That's very good.
Yeah. Listen a little to your the Close Your Eyes project, and it sounds to me like you're putting the right notes in the right place, at least most of the time.
Thanks.
That a lot.
It's funny, you know, getting older is an interesting, you know, process, as you know. But this musically, you know, it's a great thing, like, to get older, because you start to play like you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know I'm talking to another fellow jazz player, and you understand this process of longevity. Mm-hmm. You know, you start giving up the idea of trying to play like other people.
Right.
And trying to compete with other people, and really just try to enjoy the moment of playing music, and that's what I'm doing more, and that's really feels good.
Yeah, for me, I found that I just don't care anymore about what somebody thinks of my playing.
Isn't that great?
You know, I really don't.
It's really, it's so liberating that it's the best thing about aging, I think.
Yeah.
It really is. It's probably the only thing good about aging.
Well, I mean, for aging as an artist, I mean, you want to get to that point. I mean, it'd be nice if you could be there in your 20s, but we have to work for, you know, a living. And you want to get to the point where you kind of don't care what anybody thinks, but it's hard to really be there until you get some maturity and you've played like all the stuff that everybody wanted to hear, and then kind of what's left is what you want to play, you know.
Well, it's a process, you know, and certain people, you know, I guess get there sooner than others, and some people maybe never get there.
Yeah.
You know, for me as a working musician. And I've been working as a working musician, making money since I was probably in 10th or 11th grade. Mm-hmm. Sounding like other people, or trying to play styles. That's something that was always quite a fun challenge for me. And I never thought about it much except the fact that it really did give me a lot of tools to make a living playing music.
Yeah, well, you have to. You There's know. Always a point in your... I mean, if you're going to have a career...
I think everyone, no matter what, has done that, and that's part of the learning process. And there's some people that, you know, have a real strong identity when they're young. And I mean, basically a vision of themselves as a, you know, say a solo art, mm-hmm. artist, you know, and that's where they see themselves from a young age. You know, that's like, I'm going to be the next Sonny Rollins, the next Chris Potter in current times, mm-hmm. you know. For me, I did have that in my, you know, one part of my consciousness, I suppose, for sure. I had my heroes, and boy, wouldn't it be great to be the next Mike Brecker, the next Bob Berg, Bob Mintzer, Jerry Braganzi, a whole host of guys that were my heroes. Mm-hmm. But on the other side of the coin was my middle-class background, really, that my dad wanted me to be dentist or a doctor or something. Yeah. So you better learn how to make a living at this shit. You know,
Where are you from? Are you from out here?
Philly.
Oh, suburbs. Philly. Yeah.
And he was a sax player, clarinet player, weekend musician. And,
Club date guy.
And he demanded that I practice every day and get good. But when it came down to it, he didn't want me to do music for a living. So I suppose in the back of my mind, it's just like, okay, whatever gig that came around, I could do that. I can figure out how to do that. And it was, frankly, easy for me to do that. I was just, I could play that style. I could do this style.
Well, I mean, people hire you when you're young. People hire you on the basis of, can you sound like, you know, whoever it's going to be, Mike Brecker or Larry Carlton or whatever. If you can do this thing, then I'll give you this session or this gig or whatever. And you need to do that to some extent.
In our generation, it was a shared aesthetic. Listen, you better learn how to do this. Oh, I got a call to do some R&B thing. I got to figure out how to do that now.
Yeah.
You know, it was part of, actually, a great part of the learning process.
Oh, absolutely.
You know? Whereas now, you know, it's so much different because these kids are going to, you know, 6 years of college thinking that they're going to learn how to play jazz that way or learn how to improvise that way. And they're studying very esoteric music for the most part, because that's the nature of academia.
They're studying much harder than we did, I'll tell you.
The nature of academia is like, you know, okay, we could, you know, and I do this. I teach at USC. I'm a part of this, you know, the academic industrial complex, if you will.
Didn't Eisenhower warn us about that?
Yes.
You were the academic industrial jazz complex.
He should have warned us more about that, actually. Yeah, yeah. But they don't never have a chance to do any gigs, hardly.
Mm-hmm. Well, because gigs are gone.
They're just no...
Not their
fault.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting thing that that we're teaching these young players that want to become what, I'm not exactly sure, but usually they're not doing gigs. So, man, you know, it's for my musical career, let's say I have a gig on Saturday, I got to play with these people. I better prepare for that.
Right.
Because I'm going to have to play Four Freshmen stuff with this organ lounge band or something, you know, and I better, you know, figure out how to do that. Or the next day I would be playing with some salsa band in a very bad neighborhood of Philadelphia.
Yeah, we learned to mix it up because we had to.
And then you'd step on it, you know, you get there and, oh man, I just sucked on that. And then you go get the records.
Right.
And then you listen to that to figure out how to phrase that way,
But what was encouraging about those days, I think, is it was a little bit more of a process. I'm going to make a little adjustment here. Hang on. There's a little echo that's bothering me, which should be gone now. There we go. There was a little bit more of a process in that if you sucked on Tuesday night, you had a chance on Wednesday or Thursday to do something and make your mark. Whereas now, man, those gigs are largely gone. And that chance to suck every night until you get it right is pretty much going away.
That's,
you know, I don't know where kids,
that's right.
Almost everybody who's been in here, we've talked about education because it's important to me and it's important to a lot of us around our age.
I love it. Yeah. I mean, I'm good at it. I've become very good at it.
Yeah.
And I think I'm good at it because I try to, I'm sort of like a diagnostician and I hear person and see where they are and I figure out how they think, how they hear, mm-hmm. and how they learn, and then I try to approach it from that point of view. But it's it's great. This is part of the whole thing we do.
Right.
It's like we get older and we have a lot of information and a lot of stuff to give and a lot of experience to relate. Mm-hmm. And then you hand it down, you know, and it's really frustrating because and as I tell people in clinics, you know, there's not any great musician that you ever heard that you liked that learned how to do this in school.
Right, right.
It might have helped them a lot.
Oh, sure. It helps. Sure. Well, it helps shape the, you know, what's there.
I mean, it helped me a lot, just playing in all kinds of different ensembles and mm-hmm. having that sort of pressure and that challenge of having to perform. And so, I mean, just having that experience of playing in ensembles that I would have never had. That, you know, studio orchestras,
right,
and a myriad of big bands, and wind ensemble, and playing classical clarinet. Mm-hmm. I was a clarinet player. I was a legit clarinet player. That's what I wanted. It's really what I started out to do. But those experiences are great, and of course, you know, being around like-minded people, and sort of being inspired and challenged by peers. That's all well and good. But man, I was. All the other stuff in school, I mean, me and my pals, like, come on, man. That's like, you know, we're going to go down and play, you know, go sit in, and we're going to practice, and we're going to, you know, we were doing gigs.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and that's how I learned.
Well, we started early doing gigs. That's one of the things I was getting at is everybody's talked about education. We've all talked about the fact that these gigs that we used to play are gone largely. I mean, there's a few things left, but there's not much left. And now kids are getting it in college. Like one student of mine, who's a good player, and he's a senior at a local college. Mostly what he's doing is playing at other people's senior recitals. He's like the guy that gets called to do the guitar parts. He hardly ever has a gig. And when I was his age, there was work all the time. There were demo sessions, there were dance gigs, there were soul bands, there were rock bands, there were country bands. There was all this stuff to do.
Yeah,
that
well,
doesn't
they needed
exist
us
anymore. Yeah, they needed us. They needed live music. Yeah,
they didn't have the technology to replace us. Basically.
Right, right.
And basically, what now we're dealing with is what happened in Detroit, you know, in the 70s and 80s, right? The production, you know, the assembly lines were gone.
Right.
People don't have jobs now. Now, you know, they here you go. Here's a Mac in your little office here, and you're producing movie and TV stuff. And there's probably another guy on the block with the same studio.
There literally is down the block a guy with almost the same setup doing almost the same thing. Yeah.
And it's functionally for what they need. It's fine. So, I mean, that's just one example of how it's all changed. And the writing's been on the wall for a while, but I mean it's a hugely important, and as far as in the jazz world, which I was always, you know, trying to be a part of, and eventually got some notoriety in, you know, playing with Freddie Hubbard and Chick Corea, I've been really lucky to have the experience of latching on to the tail end of the greats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've played with the
some
of the great jazz people, historical jazz people, you know, and that was always, you know, boy, if I really kept practicing, maybe I'd get a chance to play with Art Blakey's band or Horace Silver's band, or, you know, of course, you know, Woody's band, and, you know, all the big bands, and there were things to point to really work towards.
Right.
So, man, if I keep doing this, and I that's what I really like to do.
Well, yeah, if I can get to do this, then they'll let me do this other thing. And if I can get to do that, then they'll let me do this. So do you find, as an educator, we're kind of crawling down a rat hole here, but it's a good one. As an educator, do you feel any guilt at all? Like what are these guys going to do when they get out of school? Or what am I sending these kids out into, as opposed to like what we had, which was the promise of a career. If you were good enough, you could make a career. Now you can be that good, but there's no guarantee of a career because it isn't the volume of work. And what are they going to do?
It's a constant source of, it's a moral dilemma.
Yeah.
It really is. Because
that's where I'm getting at, is the moral
dilemma. It's a moral dilemma. Okay. And I think it's, in a way, there's so many good things that I could talk about in the context of this, where I teach at USC, that, you know, are great. They're very positive things. There's some incredible teachers there,
yeah,
and ensembles and great stuff going on there, mm-hmm. no doubt, you know. So, but for schools all over the country, all over the world, to basically set up curriculums, knowing that there's these unsuspecting kids out there in high school bands that mm-hmm. are really digging, you know, playing in band,
yeah.
And have some sort of an idea that they want to play music, and if we set up a curriculum and get these kids to come, we could get $45,000 a year, and give them a degree in what they in what they like.
Yeah, but then
right? And it's not just jazz. This is
it's a lot of other
things. Other things. But in a way, I have a real problem with that, and I think a lot of teachers. Do. I mean, it's nothing that's new now. I mean, this jazz education, you know, something I've been involved in for quite some time, is this has been talked about a lot.
Yeah.
Yet it's an entrenched system, a way of making profit for right. universities.
And in the midst of that, the National Association of Jazz Educators no longer exists, even though there's more jazz being taught. And there's a lot of, you know, talks going on like we're talking now
yeah.
about the future of this, but there's no real organization that unites jazz educators.
Well, there's a new jazz education network that's hopefully
yeah, I've seen something about
successful
that
successful and replace that. But I mean, the going back, it's like the idea of teaching someone to be a jazz musician. I don't know. I came, you know, sort of like teaching someone to be a Viking. You know, there's not a lot of jobs for Vikings anymore.
And
I love it. See, like, you know, I think it's a worthy pursuit to practice, but it doesn't add up.
Yeah.
You know, the figures. I mean, if you're gonna let's face it, if you're gonna be a doctor or engineer or a lawyer or something, you know that it costs a lot of bread, but there's a pretty damn good chance that you're gonna. You know, get a good job.
Yeah, at least have a job. Yeah,
but
yeah.
in the jazz world, that of course does not add up at all. As mm-hmm. a matter of fact, it's you know, it used to be you know, all the jokes about being a jazz musician, yeah. right?
So playing, like, until the money runs out.
But the thing is that these kids don't know that. They see, you know. Dave Cause on mm-hmm. television, they see Kenny G, they see Sonny
yeah, but they're Rollins. A generation older than them, in some cases,
well,
two generations.
But still, they have people that on stage, are, you know, that they see in some rock band or some you know, so, oh man, if I that's what I'm going to do,
right.
you know, I'm going to be that if I get a degree. It's like, no one's told them, well, it doesn't work that way.
Well, someone yeah. should tell them. I mean,
I certainly
was going to say, you probably do. You sound like you thought about this, and
oh,
I certainly
I'm totally
do.
Honest with
I tell
you.
I tell
totally
kids or even adult students, I can train your technique, and I can train you about. I can tell you about what happens in the real world of doing this. But if you don't have inspiration, if you don't have the heart, and to some extent, if you don't have the breaks. There's nothing that, as an educator, there's nothing that I can do about that. I can't do those things for you. Those things are either there or they're not there, or if they're latent in you, you have to bring them out. Having brought them out, I can show you how to play the scale and how to get through these changes
right.
and how to relate this other stuff. Right. But then you turn them loose at the end of a few years and say, okay, now you're out there trying to steal my gigs because there's fewer and fewer gigs. I mean, that's not something we can control. We can't control the evolution of the music business. So I don't know about you, but I'm sure at USC that, and you probably do this too, I tell young students, you've got to know computer stuff. You've got to know, you've got to
Absolutely.
Be totally self-contained.
And that's
where the business is
yeah,
going.
Yeah, I mean, we're at a point where young players that are talented, and we just graduated a couple that are extremely talented, mm-hmm. and I have a feeling they're going to be okay.
Yeah.
But they're going to have to set up their own sort of paradigm of how to make a living at doing this stuff. And it is a combination. It's going to have to be a combination of many things, not just playing the horn. Right. Well, I just played. I never thought about anything except trying to sound good on my instruments, you know. And but I do tell the kids the truth. You know, I said, listen, you don't pick music, it picks you. I mean, it's literally, I mean, you can't wait to get
true.
To your instrument.
Yeah.
Man, it's just, man, I can't wait to practice. I can't figure some stuff. This is like this beautiful big puzzle that just never ends.
Yeah.
This is fascinating. And once you start playing it and you play with other like-minded people, the community of musicians, there's so many, besides loving music, there is so many other little things I realized over the years why I became a musician.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I didn't want to be one of them. Meaning, the guy that was in the car like 8 o'clock in the morning going to work every day. I didn't see myself like in a cubicle.
Yeah.
I didn't see myself as one of them. I was like, music for me was like my little vestige, like a place, like a safe place that I could be like myself.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, I'm what I do. And I know, I'm sure you feel the same way. It's like, it's very special. It's like not too many people out in the world have figured out how to do what we do.
Right.
And then I started, along the way, started meeting people, doctors and lawyers. We got people that, like if I did what my dad wanted me to do, mm-hmm. maybe I would have, been a lawyer or a dentist or something. And they'd come to me for a lesson.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Cause they, they played and they loved it. So, boy, something? I sure wish I did what you do.
I've had a couple of students. I've had a couple of doctors, especially one who's a very well-known doctor in town here, who are good enough to have been a professional musician, mm-hmm. but they've gotten to the point where they make so much money and they have so many people depending upon them, there's no way that mid-career they're going to switch and be a guitar player or a sax player or something.
Yeah.
But I've had a few guys like that who've been very, very good and could really cross over. But, they're not going to do that. But I find when I meet professionals, socially, through my wife or whatever it's going to be, they are full of questions about what I do. How does this work? You're a musician, like, all the time. First, they think that I must do something else,
Yeah.
And then when I disabuse them of that notion, it's like, that's so cool. How does that work? And they're full of questions. And a lot of times they kind of won't let go, to the point where if we're out in a social occasion or something, I find myself a little bored with answering questions about, who I was on the road with or who I've worked with or that kind of thing. Because to them, that's such a fascinating other world. I might as well be a Viking. I might as well have stories about pillaging and that kind of thing.
Right to this day, like 2 weeks ago, I was on a plane and, they got the guy, is that an instrument or something? What do you do playing a band? Must play in some rock band, people don't know what we do.
Yeah.
And I like that. Frankly, it's like I always, the community of musicians, we sort of speak a different language sort of live in a different reality. And
musicians are the best people ever.
And it's a wonderful place to be, I'm so, so grateful for all that, because it's, I have an amazing life, and this is going through the young period of being this sort of like the dark, Bob Shepard,
mm-hmm.
And you've got, those people, everything sucks. I'm a musician.
I kind of remember that guy.
I had.
I remember that guy.
That was taught.
Yeah.
That was passed down by, to me. And I know a lot of other friends of mine that sort of, we lived in this sort of like dark artistic nature, it's like, they don't get us, those idiots out there. And us, and, they're corny and blah, whatever you can say about those, the others, right?
Yeah.
And so that's one of those, there's a lot of movies about that artistic mind, but that I learned a long time ago that was stupid, actually. It's like I learned that it wasn't, that does, first of all, didn't serve me very well.
Well, it's something like, you go through, though. It's
you
part
go
of the
through
process.
It, and some people never. Actually, I know some people that never got out of it. But
yeah.
I started realizing, man, wow, this is pretty special. Man, I got a chance to play my horn with mm-hmm. these great people and actually make some money. And I started really, I turned 180 degrees in my approach to this whole thing. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and that was a huge learning experience too. It's like, what am I doing here? I got talent. I'm able to play my horn. Am I really gonna, complain about it and sort of think take that attitude that I saw other people still have and it started to bug me. It was mm-hmm. like, so man, that brings me down. It's like I could think of a couple of people that I love dearly and are amazing. It's like, but I started backing away from those people.
There are some very dark cats. I mean, no question about them.
And that's a very fascinating, interesting topic in itself, I think.
Well, I've had a couple of them in here. I'm not going to mention names, but people who listen can judge for themselves. But a lot of it is because people have been through, especially the generation older than us, the guys who are 20 years older than we are, they went through some pretty dark stuff, a lot of them, playing for no money, getting on buses and going, you know, hither and yon for no bread and no recognition and all that.
All that
and
is
that can,
true.
That can definitely true. Turn you, you know. And guys who, you know, by the time they were 30 were on their, you know, their fourth wife, those kind of things.
But it's also, there's also this sort of shared, groveling, you know, in the dirt, mire, in the mire, you know, everything. It's sort of this, it feels good to be in there with it, like complaining and just kvetching about the nature of what we do, and people don't appreciate it, and it's funny too. See, there's a sort of a fun, cynical.
Well, there's a lightness. There's a gallows humor to it. Like we're all in this together.
And that can be very funny, and when you're in it with other people, it sort of gets. It's one of those interesting parts of being a musician, I think, especially in the jazz world, that young people actually don't have.
Mm-mm.
They didn't grow up with, you know, hanging around with crusty, like nasty guys.
One thing that happened is the business sorted those guys out. Like when I started getting into playing with older guys and, you know, better guys, getting, you know, studio gigs and playing with the jazz players who had come out here, that generation that came out after the Second World War and sort of settled here, those guys were kind of getting to the point where there was less work and they were on their way out, some of them. And they got very cynical and they'd say, oh, you think this is good, kid? This is going to be your good old days. This is crap. You should have seen it in 1954. And, you know, you have to endure all those stories, a lot of which were really interesting. But you had to sort of endure all that and say, okay, that's their reality, and that was that. But one of the things that those guys had, one of the things that I really treasure that's gone, is they had stories about the great eccentric musicians. They had stories about Wingy Minone hiring the 100 bass players and cruising past them in a bus. You know that. I'm sure you know that story.
Yeah.
Those guys were sorted out by the business because as things contracted, there was no more room for eccentric guys who would play practical jokes. You had to be able to play your instrument, do the gig, get out, get on to the next gig. That was that. So that's over. That whole generation is over. And it's kind of too bad because those stories kind of leaven things a little bit. You know, hearing about some of that stuff, as dark as some of it was,
well,
it was kind of cool.
These were bigger than life people.
Yeah,
I mean, the music, playing their horn and playing the music was like serious business.
Oh, yeah.
And these people were cutting edge. They made the music. They actually like made it happen. You know, created it, and they were sort of like, you know, famous actors.
Yeah.
You know, they had these personas, and they had these bigger than life personas, and because they were so great and so talented, you as a young musician emulated that.
Yeah.
Even they emulated their music, but also I guess that's why you have to be. You have to be sort of.
Well, and the business tolerated crazy. Them. The really great players who could really execute anything and play and were great, you know, improvisers and that kind of thing. The business tolerated a few of those because they became stars and they were necessary. Now I think there's a lot less of that.
Oh, yeah,
I think because of the contraction of the business part of music, where there's less work, everybody wants it faster, everybody wants it cheaper, there's not time to indulge somebody's eccentricities, you know?
Absolutely.
It just isn't time.
I think you're right on the money, yep. Anyways, how do we get into all that?
Well, because it's interesting.
It is.
It's interesting.
Yeah, the idea of this... Because it's this process that we've been through for decades now, right?
So when did you pick up the horn? How old were you when you first picked up?
Was
the horn even the first thing, or was it something else?
Well, I wanted to play the drums, but my father brought home a clarinet when I was about fifth grade, I guess.
What did your dad do?
He was sort of a retail buyer, electronics, cameras.
Yeah.
And he was a rep for companies on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And
did your mom work too?
My mom was a housewife, basically. You know,
you got brothers and sisters, and
my sister 10 years older.
Yeah. Yeah, well, so 10 years.
10 years older.
So yeah. You guys probably didn't hang out that much.
We really didn't. No. That we probably see each other more now than we ever did.
Yeah. Because, is she here?
Her daughter has a kid, and that it sort of brought us together. So mm-hmm. She's down in Orange County, down in South Orange County. So yeah, so
So you wanted to clarinet. Play the drums, and then so the clarinet was like, "Don't play the drums. If you promise not to play the drums, I'll give you this clarinet." Was that the choice?
Here it is. And, yeah. You know, I want to play the drums, and if you want to be the first guy to the gig and the last guy home, you play the drums. But here,
and that was
because
your dad.
For now, play this.
Your dad knew some drummers, and so he understood that.
He understood that, yeah. And he was he was a sax clarinet player. Mm-hmm. So that I didn't really pick the clarinet. It just sort of.
It was there.
Showed up one day, and then he wouldn't teach me. He got me some private lessons right away. And mm-hmm. fortunately, where I grew up, there was a great feeder, school system with great music, in schools. And mm-hmm. so I immediately got in a band, and it was sort of off to the races, because there was a lot of music always and the great players around. And competition. And
when did you switch over to sax?
I just added it. I never switched. I mean, I never gave up the clarinet, but I suppose seventh grade probably, where there was a little jazz band mm-hmm. in junior high. So I got an alto and I started to play that. And not too many lessons on the saxophone. There was a couple of professionals in the neighborhood that would give me some pointers and few lessons here and there, but basically I studied the clarinet real seriously. Mm-hmm. That's what my dad said. I mean, you gotta play classical clarinet because the saxophone's easy. And he was right, comparatively,
So he thought you'd be like an orchestra guy or...
studied classical clarinet and the other stuff. He knew that if I had ears, the other thing I'll figure out. And mm-hmm. it was right. I just played along with the music. I tell my students, one of the a major factor in how I learned how to improvise was playing along with the television, because in my house the television mm-hmm. was like another part of the family. Mm-hmm. It sort of sat on this little thing next to the kitchen table where we all ate, and it was always on, and my parents were always kvetching and bickering. Mm-hmm. and I would just have a flute or a clarinet or something and played along with all the themes.
With the themes,
all the underscoring. And
I'm glad somebody else did that.
And just played along. try to play in tune, try to improvise with the tonalities. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's how I learned how to play. It was just like, I got my ear, you just be able to lock in on just about anything.
Well, and you played a lot of, if you were doing that, you were playing a lot of styles, because they were still, the TV themes in those days were basically big band jazz. Right. And there was rock and roll just sort of creeping in, some little backbeats and things. It was much more eclectic than it is now.
Yeah, I just heard it, and it got my mind off of the arguing mm-hmm. in the house, and somehow my parents just let me do it. I don't know. They never said like, just get out of here.
Maybe they didn't notice. Is that?
Maybe so. Maybe they were so involved in their arguments that they didn't notice me. But I just sort of always did.
Did they stay together? Did they split?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. They're from a generation that stuck together.
Yeah. Are they still around?
No, unfortunately, they passed quite a while ago. So Philly was a great place to learn how to play music because this the suburbs that had these great school systems, and I was in a award-winning jazz band in high mm-hmm. school. We always had Maynard in and Ken Kenton's band in, and every year we had real great bands come. And my dad used to take me out to hear live music,
That's nice.
I mean, there were places to hear, Charlie Ventura, mm-hmm. this place up in Langhorne, PA, and this place in Trenton, New Jersey, where we used to go to hear some music, and it was just everywhere. And when I finally started playing in little bands, like the first band I played in was a little soul band mm-hmm. called the Zebras. And it's like half white and half black guys, and we were playing these bars, in your Jersey and all around it. It's like, and I was like, I shouldn't have been let into these bars.
Yeah, you were too young.
So I remember my first gig was my dad had to drive me to this place up in New Hope, Pennsylvania. And I don't know how I got the gig, some older guy with a cordovox,
naturally,
and a drummer at a bar, and there I was, like, you know, okay, kid.
You were probably cheap. That's probably
how I got was very the gig. Cheap.
You probably were willing to work cheap.
I don't know how I got that job. It's really I wish I could remember, but maybe my dad said, "Oh, I'll get hire my
could
son."
Be, yeah.
It's very possible that's what happened. But I remember faking my way through these tunes that I never played. But, you know, they were in my back of my head.
Yeah.
You know? I played along with
you had
with
big ears.
So, you know, I just completely step on it. But by the second chorus, I would start to hear it and get better. And how about a learning experience?
Yeah,
that was.
That's great.
You know, that
that's
was
great.
That was the best.
Did you ever go to gigs with your dad? Did he ever take you along and say, "Hey, watch this kid. This is what you do."
Yeah, he
you
was know? Like a, he always had some little society band that he played in, and there were these community little concert bands. That's always in those with him. And,
right.
So those were great experiences.
That's
you know?
Cool.
And then I went to school for pre-med.
Pre-med.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Where'd
you go?
I got accepted to a place called Rider College. It's near Princeton.
They have a band?
No. I went there and I started getting tons of, you know, whatever, chemistry.
With, so where did that come from? That's
because he wanted me to be a dentist.
Oh, but I'm so you kind of swallowed that and said, oh, okay, I'll be
okay,
a dentist.
I'm going to do that. Yeah. And I went to school and then I come home and play along with Miles and train. And basically almost flunked out.
Yeah.
I did not do well. And
how
I
long
said,
did you last as?
Oh, not pre-med. Very long. Yeah. I think one semester.
Mm-hmm.
I tell all my people that my friends, as well as saying, if they have any medical problems, like, you know, I took one semester of pre-med, so
you can really help
so
them
I
out.
Could really, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Don't ask Bob Shepard if it hurts somewhere. Just keep it to yourself.
Yeah. So that was. A learning experience because I figured, well, it looks like, you know, I should not be doing this.
Right.
I should go into music. And then I switched majors.
And schools.
Yeah. So I had to get my big grade average up. So I went to a community college, actually, in Bucks County, which had a great little program.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of great teachers there, actually. And said I did that. And then I was always doing gigs, kept doing gigs. I always had a wedding band playing, always had some sort of a gig. To do, and then I transferred to Glassboro State College. It's now called Rowan University, and that was great because it was a great program there, and we actually had a very famous arranger, composer Manny Album.
Oh yeah,
who taught there, and we had studio orchestra, and man, that was great because I was. Just doing that. I was playing gigs around Philly, you know, met the flute player in the wind ensemble, right? And that was great.
It's okay.
And then everything.
I can get that out.
I was working. I was a working musician in Philly, really. I was young, and doing okay. And I had a girlfriend. We were engaged. And Manny Album goes. I think you should go to Eastman. I really think there's a new program up there, and I think you should go. And I said, well, I don't know. Doing pretty cool here. No. You should really go. And my girlfriend goes, oh, man, you know. Well, okay, but I'll plan the wedding, and, you know, you do that, but I'll plan the wedding. And off I went to Eastman to do my master's degree. And I forgot about my girlfriend, because I was all of a sudden I was like in another world of like, oh my God, this is people that actually stay in the practice rooms for 8 hours a day.
Right.
Literally scared the hell out of me. And, but that was like another life. You know, my life is sort of separated by these little moves, you know, and, met a whole set of musicians up there that I play with to this day.
Yeah. Who'd you meet at Eastman that you still play with? That we would know.
Oh, well, at the time, you know, there were the guy that brought me to L.A. to do a record. I was never west of Harrisburg, and I was actually teaching in New Orleans at the time at this Loyola University, and he brought me to LA because he had a record deal. John Serry, do you remember a guy named John Serry?
I remember hearing the name, but I don't.
He was quite really a character and a brilliant, brilliant composer, yeah, and piano player and percussionist. Mm-hmm. And he moved out here with a group called Oracle.
Oh yeah, I remember Oracle.
And Rick Braun, yeah, was a trumpet player, and Ron Wagner was a drummer. Excellent musicians, and Steve Kajala.
Oh yeah.
Who's a dear friend of mine, mm-hmm, and one of the great flute players in the world, mm-hmm, and played saxophone, and just all these Eastman people out here, mm-hmm, like not necessarily from my 2 years, but that I met because of Eastman, you, yeah, know, Bill Cunliffe and, mm-hmm, and Steve Bramson, great composer, and Devin Manson. There's just a host of, Al Vizzuti was there. Mm-hmm. Doug Walter,
right?
I could go on and
a lot
on.
Of guys, yeah.
On and on. There's, and who would have known that these guys would have been, you know, my future colleagues and actually people that I work for, mm-hmm, you know, used to work for when, right, it was a business.
Yeah.
So Eastman was a very important, and I played with Chuck Mangione's big orchestra thing, you, mm-hmm, know, like when he had that thing there, and yeah. And then I got a gig playing at a steady dinner theater where we played for Tony Bennett to God knows who. Mm-hmm. I played second alto next to Joe Romano. Yeah. And boy, did I learn something there.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Talk so this about is it. a fertile time.
Oh, it was fantastic.
Yeah.
And then shows would come in. I would do the ice capades. I would do the circus.
Right.
You know, I was going to school, but still working, mm-hmm, you know, and getting all this experience. And
so what year is this? You remember? Or what time?
Well, around it was 77, 78, I think.
So what brought you out here for good? Or what happened from there that got you, like, out of school? You completed your master's?
Completed my master's.
Yeah.
Was just working around Rochester, getting, mm-hmm, ready to move to New York.
Right.
That's where I always wanted to be, and this was my plan. And about, you know, somewhere around August 1st or something like that, I get this call early one morning from the dean of music at Loyola University. Somebody had dropped my name. Mm-hmm. They needed somebody to teach saxophone, jazz studies, and related stuff. And are you interested in interviewing for this job? I said, I guess, you know. Yeah. And I ended up flying down there and doing the audition. And, mm-hmm, they gave me the job.
So how long were you in New Orleans?
Well, I told myself I was only going to do it for 2 years. And I went down there, and that was quite an experience because I immediately started working down there.
Yeah, there's so much to do.
There was a lot to do,
yeah,
and met a lot of great players and had a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And
there was a lot of fun to be had there.
Oh, my God, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And I got a lot of great experience playing there and met some great players. But my whole idea was to go to New York. And at the end of 2 years, I took a leave of absence. Mm-hmm. And this was the time where that my friends from Eastman were moving. There was this migration to L.A. rather than New York at that time.
Why was that?
I have no idea. I think that because of just opportunities that were there. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. I really I'll come out and do this record, you know, and flew out there and, mm-hmm, hung out for a little bit. And this next thing I knew, I was starting to do stuff, you know, little rehearsals at the Union, mm-hmm, blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay, I'm going to try out L.A. And I met this girl in Europe, mm-hmm, beautiful Swedish girl I fell in love with, and she happened to be visiting me, and I remember driving my little tiny roller skate Honda Civic, my orange Honda Civic, with a U-Haul trailer with my Swedish girlfriend, mm-hmm, across Route 10 all the way to California. First time I ever saw a cactus or a mesa or anything. It was like quite a drive.
Yeah.
And we made it, and I found an apartment on Laurel Canyon, mm-hmm, Studio City, And man, that was 1980, fall of 1980. I moved to LA, and without any knowledge of LA, about no knowledge of.
But you knew people out here.
I had my friends.
Yeah.
But that was a great experience. Any time I moved, actually, it was a great experience. It was very, you get stronger and when you have to start over.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's all up to you.
And now I've been here a long time, and it's hard to believe, actually, how fast it's gone by. But, in a nutshell, you know, I was never anywhere except, you know, up and down the East Coast, you mm-hmm. know, and all of a sudden I'm in L.A. and you know, a few years go by, I'm playing, you know, club dates, the casuals we call them,
right.
And I got into Toshiko's, Lou Tabak and Toshiko Akiyoshi, a big band.
Mm-hmm.
That was great. I started to go to Europe, started to go to Japan. And soon after that, I met a guy named Billy Childs. And Billy heard me and said, hey, you know, Freddie Hubbard might need a tenor player. You should come down and sit in at the, remember the Parisian room?
Oh, sure. Yeah, Freddie Jett's Parisian, or no, Freddie Jett's Pied Piper, the Parisian room on La Brea and
right. And Washington, I went down yeah. there and I was, you know, there was a comedian and Freddie Hubbard, you know, my
yeah,
God,
right.
like one of my biggest heroes in life. You know, he was on stage mm-hmm. and I'm going, what am I doing here? And I actually go up and sit in and play with this guy. And I went up and somehow, you know, I get. He never said anything. I don't know if I did. I must have done okay.
Cause yeah, you got the
next
gig.
Thing I know, his manager's calling me, and I get a gig. And I am I in the band? I never knew if I was in his band.
Mm-hmm.
And but I ended up playing with Freddie Hubb for on and off for like seven, almost 8 years, I think. And they're talking about learning.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. I would have never gotten that experience. Probably have never gotten to play with Freddie Hubbard if I moved to New York, because I would have been among, you know, 30 or 40 tenor players that Freddie would have called. But
right.
in L.A., since I was, if you will, a New York influenced tenor
right.
player, you know, I wanted to play like Train and
yeah, you're a harder player than some of the guys out here.
At that time, there wasn't a lot of guys that were trying to play like that.
Right.
So in L.A., I was sort of, I guess, you know, unique that I played like that. Mm-hmm. So he gave me a shot. And so in a way, L.A. was, you know, very good for me.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, it's definitely been very good for me. So it's been interesting how, you know, as I tell young players now, you never know what your path is going to take you, you know.
What was the whole Freddie experience like? I mean, was he stable at the time? Was it craziness, up and down, roller coaster? Was it...
All the above.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Freddie was a loose cannon.
Yeah.
You know, so I had to learn how to deal with that,
mm-hmm.
you know, being on stage and not knowing, you know, what was going to... Is it my turn to be humiliated?
Yeah. Who was on the band at the time with you? You remember?
There was sort of a revolving. Freddie would use band back east, pick mm-hmm. up a band there, pick up, you know, west of the Mississippi. You know,
right.
He had a band in the East Coast. But then so I did some tours with him in Europe, and it was always different people. Ralph Penland on mm-hmm. drums a lot. You know, when I first started, it was Billy Childs,
and yeah, piano player.
Herbie Lewis and John Beasley.
Mm-hmm.
We did a lot together, played a lot, and a lot of different players. He would just he wanted at the you know there was quite about a handful of guys that would you never knew who was going to be in there. It was never a rehearsal,
right.
He just sort of showed up for the gig. Usually Freddie was not there and got there late.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just an experience that I treasure. But Freddie, just trying to follow Freddie Hubbard was frightening.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you never know who he's going to call. You know, it was one of those real experiences that made me stronger.
It sounds like fun, but the kind of thing where you're always looking around and make sure you're... you know where you're at too.
It was it was so much fun to play, and but terrifying in the same way.
So what happens?
Stories, you know.
What happens after that? After Freddie?
Well, I was always, you know, Freddie. That was sort of one of those gigs that
comes and goes.
Once in a while.
Yeah.
So I was just being an LA musician,
right,
which meant doing all the myriad of things that we do, you know. And fortunately, I met, remember Jim Fox?
Oh, sure.
I met him early on, and we
started... something happened to Jim Fox?
No, he's actually alive and well.
Yes,
and playing great.
Yeah.
We just, I just sat in with him actually last week, and but he, we started working for his office, and we were doing, you know, two or three little casuals a week, you know, and they could have been anything.
Yeah.
Someone's house to a Macy's or something, you know. And they were great because we just played tunes.
Yeah.
So that paid my rent. And then I was doing rehearsal bands, and I was doing Toshigo's big band, right? And then that gave me something to do. And I was doing other rehearsal bands, and I started playing with Bill Watrous's Refuge West. And that was, you know, that happened sort of pretty soon. And I, next thing I know, I was doing a little horn section recording, you know, for something, you know, and someone doing a rehearsal band, they heard me play, I call this guy. And all of a sudden, like, I'm sitting at a session with guys that, like, I have on my records.
Yeah.
Like, man, wow, I can't believe it. I'm next to Bob Cooper or, you know, like Jack Nimitz, guys like that, you know. It's like, huh, this is cool. Right, so all of a sudden I'm like, you know, making some decent money here and there playing some sessions, you know, and you know how it works, you know, one thing leads to another,
right.
And you'll meet this guy, and all of a sudden I'm doing jingles. Next thing I'm doing a movie for this guy, and then I have like a myriad of accounts just working in L.A. as a sideman, as a freelance player, doing a show once in a while, you know. Then I get a chance to play with Randy Brecker.
So how did that come about?
Randy heard me play with Freddie and hired me for a gig at Catalina down in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And because I was doing that gig, Walter Becker from Steely Dan comes in and he hears me play. I said, hey, blah, 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 nice to meet you. Next thing you know, I get a call to go on the road with Steely Dan.
So that's pretty cool.
You never, it's like I tell these people, you never know what's going to happen. You better play no matter what.
Yeah,
you
better play good.
Rehearsal, that's the last time you play is that you got to play good.
Yeah.
Because you never know where your gig's going to come from.
Right.
Right. So that was really exciting because I never really did a large scale sort of, you know, pop gig. You know? And that was great.
So how was that? How long were you on the road with them?
Well, those tours were like maybe six to 8 weeks long.
How many tours did you do?
I did about three or four tours.
So was it cool being part of the pop circus or?
It was a ball.
Yeah.
I just loved it. And the music's so hip, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a jazz gig, but there were places to blow.
It's a jazzy gig,
And it was so... It was so much fun to play that music in front of, you know, 20,000 people or whatever.
With good musicians.
And we had, you know, I was never treated like that, you know, the Four Seasons hotels and catering and someone carrying my bag, you know, like for me, that was like, wow, this is great. so that's how that happened. And then, you know, playing with Chick was another huge thing.
So how'd you get that?
I got that gig because I was playing with Mike Stern.
The guitarist?
Mike Stern, the guitarist. Mm-hmm. I got Mike Stern's gig because he heard me play somehow, somewhere. And Bob Berg, we were friends along the way. Bob and I became friends, and he couldn't do a tour. Or I had to come in the middle of a tour and sub for him. So call this guy, I'll be able to do it. And I flew to Sardinia to make this in some mountain.
Yeah.
Up in the mountainside, I'll never forget that day. And I started playing with Mike Stern and Ron Moss, Chick Corea's manager at the time, heard me play with Mike somewhere in on the road. Mm-hmm. And Chick was putting together a new band, and he wanted a guy that played doubles, clarinet, bass clarinet, flute, mm-hmm. tenor. And all of a sudden, I get a call from Chick Corea one day. It's like, would you like to be a part of this band I'm starting? It's going, oh, like, yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
No one's going to say no to that.
And that was another amazing experience for me that opened up a whole another world, you know, of mm-hmm. Musicians and so
did you record with Chick?
Yeah a couple records and then because of playing with Chick. Well, I got a chance to play with Herbie a little bit, mm-hmm. Just a little video thing, but you know these cool, like Joni Mitchell. How did I played that tour with Joni Mitchell when she did all the standards
and oh, yeah.
both sides now, you know, Vince Mendoza yeah. project and what a thing that was.
That must have been great.
Oh, I was subbing for Wayne Shorter, who did the record. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh my God, how did I get myself into this
pretty
stuff?
Nice. You know?
And when I think about it all, it just seems like a natural progression, you know, just like all the gigs I did when I was a kid. So I used to do a wedding band with this guy. All of a sudden I was doing it. It's like the guy heard me, and it's like, that's the way it happened.
Yeah, right? It's all linked in together.
It's all this path, this tree, mm-hmm. this, you know, one of those one of those trees, you know, what do you call it? Like a family tree.
Right.
Where you start here and then you met this guy.
All little branches, yeah.
The branches keep going and going and going,
right.
You know. So now the tree is more like a bush.
You know? Yeah, okay. All different directions. Yeah, that's cool. And what about your own records? How did that begin?
Well, I'm not recorded very well. I it's one of those things where I was so busy and having fun playing for everyone else. I never really concentrated on my own.
Well, you've done a few though.
I've done a few, but yeah. I mean, you know, I should have 5 or 6 under my belt at this point, mm-hmm. at least. So now I'm trying to make up for lost time, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that process is something that I love to do, and mm-hmm. I just haven't done it enough, you know, writing tunes and having a band. And now I'm really trying to re-identify myself as a band leader, mm-hmm. now, because I've been known as a sideman.
You know? It's a hard thing to do, don't you find? I mean, I've found that
especially
as well.
Now.
Yeah. You get pigeonholed as somebody who can be a chameleon or who wants to be a side person, and then it's harder and harder to get your own project going.
It's easier to be a sideman.
Yeah.
Let's face it. You know, and I guess you could say I'm lazy or something, you know. It's just harder to be your own guy, because mm-hmm. it takes a singular effort and concentration every day to keep it going.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think phone will ring and it's easier to just pick up the phone and
right.
so look at your calendar. So sure, I'll be there and take the check. And then you're not invested.
No, but the downside of that is that you're not invested.
I mean,
it's always
right.
somebody, you're always contributing to somebody else's thing and making that better. And while it's flattering that they want you to make a contribution, you're not building anything of your own, you know, you're not leaving anything behind of your own.
Who would have known that, you know, just sort of, I knew it in the back of my mind, but it was just, you have to really want it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if I wanted to be like a solo, have my own solo career, I should have been working on this for 20, 25 mm-hmm. years ago.
Well, it's very seductive when people want you to play too, you know, and it's, I mean, I found it so that when people say, oh, you could add to this, or could you do this for me? I really appreciate that. I appreciate being asked. I appreciate also on some level not having to make the effort to put something together. Somebody else is doing all that work, so all I have to do is show up and play, you know, look at the pages and play them. But you do leave something of yourself behind that you don't, that's not there when you want to, you know, use your own resources.
You know, it's when you're busy and you have commitments to accounts, people that depend on you, and there's something to do every week, mm-hmm. that becomes its own thing that's hard to break away from, because you have to leave it. If you really want to be a solo, have a solo career, you have to make serious decisions about your time.
Right.
And
right.
that means you're going to have to cut off your income streams and say, okay, I'm going to do this. Mm-hmm. I'm really going to commit to myself, you know, and maybe that's, you know, that's something for my my analyst to get at, but there is something there, you know, like about, do I really want to commit to myself? Do I really think I have enough to offer?
Well, it has to do with exposing yourself too, with saying, okay, this is me. I'm not hiding behind somebody else's music or somebody else's gig or their persona. This is me. Do you like this? Right. Here, do you like, this is what I am. Do you like this? You want this? Right. Or would you rather have me hiding behind, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
it's a different choice.
It is a different choice, and the part of wanting that is there's seeing yourself that way, you know, as wanting attention. You know, let's face it, you want that attention to your music. You just want the attention, and I was never one of those guys that cared too much about getting attention mm-hmm. as much as I wanted to play and just keep doing it. You know, and so. You have to really want that attention, and you have to, think of yourself in terms of as, you know, a business,
mm-hmm.
you know, and do all the stuff that you need to do as a business. Which is a lot.
Yeah.
And the other idea of being a pragmatist is like, I've worked for a lot of leaders
mm-hmm.
and I see what it is. Say, man, do I really, can I do that? Can I really do that, put up with all that crap mm-hmm. and all the stuff that you need to do to be a leader I looked at it in a way that, man, I don't know if that's for me, you know? It's like, you know, I don't see myself doing that. At the same token, it's like, man, what am I doing? I can write good tunes, you know? I know how to produce. I'm really good at that, mm-hmm. you know? And I know how to put people together. You know, I'm going to do this. I don't care what happens. You know? So now, you know, here I am, like trying to rebrand myself mm-hmm. as Bob Shepherd, and you know, my expectations are just of one. I'm just playing, trying to continue to play, but more of my own music. And it's happening a little bit, you know. It's very difficult now to bring a band on the road. It's very expensive.
Yeah.
So once in a while I get an opportunity to have my own band. I have a couple of things in LA mm-hmm. coming up, but you know, it's going to be more featured with other musicians mm-hmm. that I could pick up.
Do you have a set working band? I mean, when you're in town?
I have guys I love to play with, you know. Larry Kuntz on guitar and recently Derek Oles on
bass.
My friend Jeff D'Angelo, I play with a lot. And drummers, you know, if I could get Peter Erskine, mm-hmm. that's great. Sometimes he's just too busy. But Mark Ferber
mm-hmm.
Is a guy that was in New York but comes back here a lot.
He's from
the Bay Area and he's lived here. And there's a great drummer I play with a lot. Steve Haas in mm-hmm. town is great. And anyway, there's
good guys.
There's good guys, and that's what I'm doing. Just trying to concentrate more on myself. You know, now that the business is on, let's say, a, you know, downward slope. You know?
Right. Have you stopped taking side musician gigs, or you just prefer to concentrate more on your own thing, or?
Well, no, I still need to work.
Yeah.
I still need to make a living. I'm a little bit more selective, mm-hmm. you know. And so, I'll still take, especially jazz gigs. You know, I love playing with great players. So I do that. But I mean, as far as like, you know, I just played at Disney Concert Hall. Did a show for Elaine Stritch. Mm-hmm. I worked the other night at the Greek Theater with Kristen Chenoweth. Mm-hmm. These are, you know, they're shows.
These are good, but they're good gigs. Yeah.
And they're good gigs.
Yeah, you're treated right. And I enjoy that.
And yeah. I enjoy the craftsmanship, you know. Right. To sit next to a fellow woodwind player and mm-hmm. and try to nail the parts and stuff. I still love that.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Sure.
And I really do. That's how I grew up, is doing that. And I don't want to give that up. So.
How long have you been at USC?
That's a good question. It's probably, you know, 7 years.
Yeah.
How'd that start?
Were you recruited or did you?
They needed ancillary, you know, just part time. Mm-hmm.
So that's a good situation at USC, from what I hear.
Yeah, I mean, it fluctuates from 3 to 6 students a semester, mm-hmm. and that's I wouldn't want more than that, really. It gets a little hard to juggle that, you know? But I really do love the kids down there, because they're obviously serious and they are into it.
There's some great young players. I went last week. We went and heard the A band, the Cal State Northridge A band.
Oh, that's great.
And I heard a couple of players that are just, I mean, they're totally ready. You know, mm-hmm. there's no more education needed. These guys are totally ready. They've got the chops. They've got the improvisation chops, as well as, you know, they can execute, and they're there, you know. It's good to see.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun.
I was, I don't know why I was surprised, but I was, you know, it was just, they were just so good that it was better than I thought it would be.
Yeah. And Matt Harris is the head of that program, and he's quite a great.
Yeah. Well, Diversa did the A-band this year. Matt took a sabbatical.
Oh, that's right. John was at USC.
Yeah, I know.
And now he's there. Man, to have John there is great.
Yeah, he's given them a little extra.
And my friend Rob teaches saxophone.
Rob Lockhart, yeah.
And, Rob Lockhart's tremendous saxophone player and doubler and Gary Pratt. Mm-hmm. And that's a great faculty.
It really is. Yeah. It really is. It's a little gem over there.
Yeah.
Well, very cool. Anything else you want to say? Mm. We've ended up where we began.
I need
talking
a cup of coffee,
education.
I'll tell you that.
Do you? I'm sorry, I didn't. I should have made coffee.
I forgot to have my coffee today. That was a big mistake.
No.
So I don't know. It's up to you. As you know, I sort of was blabbering on here.
Well, that's actually what it's about, so that's okay.
It's not about me. It is interesting trying to, you know, go back in their memory banks and figure out like how things happened, like, you know.
I find that interesting. I found one of the really interesting things about doing this is finding out how people got from point A to point Z. It's like, and it generally turns out for most of us to be the same process. So you're playing with somebody somewhere and somebody says, oh, you know, I need someone to do this. You could do that, you know, even when you don't think that you're the guy who could do that, you know, somebody else says, oh, you could do this gig. You want to do this gig? And before you know it, you're doing that gig.
Yeah. You know? Just, being in New Orleans, mm-hmm. right. All of a sudden I was down there. And the guy that was teaching, the head of the program there, a great jazz piano player. So, you want to play with Nat Adderley? and it was just this dumpy little club on Rampart Street, you know. It's like, yeah. So, it turned out that that was the first gig that Nat played since Cannon died.
Really?
Right? So I would be the first alto player.
Wow.
That Nat would play with, you know, I don't know. He just took
that's pretty cool.
Months off.
Yeah.
Along after Cannonball died. And I'm going to be playing with Nat early after Cannonball. Like, right. So I did this little gig in New Orleans and Nat was just lovely. Mm-hmm. And he just, you know, said, man, yeah, sound great, man. You know, yeah, it's beautiful. And next thing you know, like when I moved to LA, I get a call to play with him at Concerts by the Sea. Mm. And I got a chance to play with Victor Feldman.
Ah, yeah.
It's like, man, I actually played with Victor Feldman, you know? I mean, it's being at the right place.
Yeah. Yeah.
At the right time. And it's a lot of luck. A lot of luck involved, you know?
Well, it's a lot of luck in terms of getting the gigs, but then this is the old thing. You have to be prepared when you get that call to then go in and do what they're asking of you. Yeah.
The luck happens. Yeah. It's your time to do it.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And that's why I did this clinic a couple of weeks ago for the LA Unified School District. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was this business of music class, you know, that people were talking about what you should do to, you know, what you... These kids are in high school, you know, it's like you got to, you know, start working, marketing and how you see yourself. And I, it sort of bugged me, you know, so listen, this... They said, listen, there's Bob Shepherd, you know, he does studio work, blah, blah, blah. You know, so I said, well, listen, I never didn't know what studio work was. You know, I didn't know what it was.
Right.
And I, all I can say is you don't have any control over any of it. You just, the only thing you do have control over is how you play.
Right.
Right. And that is what you should be concentrating on, not thinking about how to get, you know, on, you know, a road with, you know, with somebody or on TV with somebody. You don't know how that's going to work out.
Well, that's what happens, I think, when you have, I don't know who the teacher was, but when you have classroom teachers who've never been out in the real world and doing this, and they think that it goes X way, and then guys like us who've been doing it come in and we give a guest lecture or a clinic or something, and we say, well, you know, it really, I don't want to contradict your teacher that you're with 5 days a week, but this is kind of the way it is out in the real world. It's an interesting conundrum, you know.
Well, I love to contradict them. That's I because most of the time, these kids aren't getting what they need.
Well, I just want to be polite because I don't want to be.
No, definitely.
When I leave, that teacher still has to face them 5 days a week. You know?
No, that's absolutely true. Yeah. But I mean, I think that's why my clinics are well received. Mm-hmm. Not because I go, you know, I'm there to get...
No, but you're somebody who's done stuff.
So listen, you're getting all this great stuff here. I know that. You're getting all the pieces, right? You're getting, you know, the chord scales, all the theory, all everything. You know, I have no doubt that you're getting everything you need, right? So I'm here for a short period of time, and I'm going to try to give you some other ideas of how to practice.
Right.
And give you some stuff that you they can't teach you in school, because a lot of the stuff that you need to learn cannot be taught.
Right.
But there's ways to get at it, you know. And so that's what I try to do when I
yeah,
that's
a good way to get into it, you know. Well, like in I studied architecture briefly in college, and there were classes called pro practice, which was not how to design and make up two pieces of wood join, or learning that a third of the span can cantilever and all that. It's actually how to run an architectural office, how to exist as a low-paid associate in that system and all that, which I never went into. But those ideas of pro practice, of professional practice, of what do you do when you're actually doing this, aside from the skills you hopefully already have, how do you actually make this work? And it's kind of like, you know, what we go in when we do a clinic and say, okay, this is the deal for playing a record date, or this is the deal when you're playing it with a touring act, or this is how you practice for this kind of thing. It's a whole different thing than what people learn at school.
Right. Well, the thing that I demonstrate, which is pretty funny actually, is you know, the kid can play, might be able to play, you know, a few Charlie Parker 2/5s and do some fancy, you know, patterns, stuff like that. And then, okay, cool. Play this note. Bam. And they go, and they find the note.
Right.
You know, they're hunting for the notes on their horn, right? So, okay, there you got the notes. Now play it like this. Now put some feeling on it, some stylistic thing on it. So there you go. That's how you learn how to play, right? You just copied me.
Yeah.
You used your ear, right? And so play happy, sing happy birthday. You know, they sing happy, you know, they can find the key. I say, okay, find the starting note and play it. You know that, like, I would say that 75% of them can't play happy birthday.
No.
I mean, everyone knows, you know.
Everyone knows it, but just, not everybody can do it.
But, so that means that they're not picking up their horn and playing melodies in their head.
Yeah.
And playing along with music. And making it sound like the music. They're into the whatever it was, the left side of the brain or whatever that...
I always get that confused.
That controls...
The organized one,
okay, you know, this is your lesson, Billy. You know, you do this, and you practice this, and they could do that, right? And they could read the music, and they could, you know, do what the teacher says. But they're not picking up their instrument and having fun with it.
Yeah.
Right? And that's what I try to do, is like have them... there's all kinds of ways to have fun.
Oh, absolutely.
On your instrument, yeah. Which teach you how to play. And that's the thing that is lacking in, it's the nature of academia. It's not nobody's fault. It's
no, just, it's well, you just have to teach is, that, you know? That which can be taught.
Yeah,
you have to find a way to do
that's
that.
Right.
But you know, the downside of that approach is that most of the time you're hired for who you are, for what you can play from here, from your heart, rather than what you can actually, what you can actually expound, what you can actually execute, you know?
That's right.
People hire you for what, if there's 30 saxophone players.
I don't care what degree you have, I don't care.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't, it makes no difference in the world.
Well, I mean, if
there's teach again, of course, but yeah. To actually play, no one, who cares?
Well, if there's 30 saxophone players lined up in a line who can all execute pretty much the same way, who can all play pretty much the same doubles, who all have the pretty much the same physical command over their horn, the one who's going to get the interesting gig is the one who can really play from the heart and reach people and really make people want to hear himself or herself.
And have some sort of a personality that,
right.
That evokes something on their instrument.
And that unfortunately can't be taught, but that doesn't mean it shouldn't be mentioned. You know, it needs to be mentioned and it needs to be brought to, you know, people's attention.
But the way to learn how to do that is to actually have inspiration and go after the inspiration the way musicians always went after the inspiration
and pursue
by
that.
by their ear.
Yeah.
And you know, people think they can learn something and be individuals without checking out what came before them. And I get that a lot. You know, I don't want to play like him. I don't want to play like myself. Well, I hate to tell you, the only way you're going to ever be able to play like yourself is to figure out, find people that just you love.
Right.
Doesn't have to be who I tell you.
No, it has to be who you look.
But who that just pulls at you, man? Oh my God! If I don't figure out how to do that, that's it. That's it, right? Just find those people and go and figure out how they do it, because that process will teach you how to play.
Yeah. Who'd you listen to? Who were the people for you?
Oh man, you know. Well, the classic. I mean, Train turned my life around.
Yeah. Did you do transcriptions and study?
I did some transcriptions, but mainly just played along with him. Listened, played along. You know, just try to. And still, and when I hear Train and put on Ron right now, and I would just, oh, thank you.
Yeah.
It's like, that's the way I feel. You know, Mike Brecker had a huge influence on me. Joe Henderson, Sonny Rollins.
Yeah.
And then the post train guys like Steve Grossman and Dave Liebman and Jerry Bergonzi and Bob Berg, Bob Minzer, and you know, host of other guys, you know, like never.
Did you listen to singers at all? Did you listen to other players who weren't saxophone players? I mean, did you get inspiration in those?
Yeah, loved guitar players. Mm-hmm. Loved guitar players. You know, just, you know, trumpet player. I mean, it's, if, you know, ask any 20 jazz players, you could probably cross-reference the same people.
Yeah, yeah.
But along the way, there's some people that really, really got me, you know. Like Nat.
Yeah, Nat Adderley.
Nat King Cole.
Oh, Nat King Cole.
Oh.
Yeah.
When I heard that, it's like, oh my God, that's it. Right? You know, Nancy Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
Loved Nancy Wilson, Sarah Vaughan.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, when you're really young, you say, singers. You know, it's like I'm more into the technical part of it.
Yeah, you have to kind of come out the other side of it and begin to appreciate people who do things with simplicity and who are direct. You know.
But now, you know, I had a girlfriend as a singer a while back, and she turned me on to a lot of lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and now I want to hear a great singer.
Well, Lester Young really always says you got to know the lyrics to play the tune, you know.
Yeah, it's really true. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot to that. But when you're young, you know, you're into the, you know, the sports part of it. You know,
chops.
The athletic part of the chops.
Yeah.
Cool. Anyway, so I could tell there's my voice is getting lower and more gravelly.
Gravelly. Well, this was good. This is good. I appreciate it. Thanks for coming by.
I appreciate it, Rick. Thanks for your interest in having me over.
Yeah, it was fun. Bob Shepherd.